President Obama's administration is still pushing to raise the federal minimum wage. In the meantime, there are many minimum wages. In addition to the existing federal minimum, some states have their own, and even some cities do. It's a patchwork of minimum wages across the map. And we're going next to a shopping mall that sits on two different patches at once. Here's Steve Henn with NPR's Planet Money team.
The Valley Fair Mall straddles two different cities. One side is in Santa Clara, but walk a few feet down the mall and you're in a different city, San Jose. In 2012, San Jose voted to raise its minimum wage from $8 to $10 an hour. And this caused some problems.
Right when it changed, we lost about a good five good employees.
This is Philip Sandigo, a shoe store manager here at the Shoe Palace on the $8 side of the mall. He lost about half of his staff in just a couple months, and they didn't go far. There were shoe stores on the other side of the mall paying $2 an hour more.
They just up and were like, see ya, we like you, but
no,
sorry.
We love you, but, and I understand it, you know, nothing you could do. They paid $2 more, so an hour, so that's a big difference. So I really couldn't blame them. I didn't get mad, I just said, okay, good luck.
He asked the store owners if he could raise wages, and they said no. 2 years later, it's still a struggle to hire new employees.
We get the bottom of the barrel here. And you could tell right off the bat. They come in, one kid came in high the other day, you know, drugs. You just, those are the kids you get.
It's awkward as he's saying this because standing right next to us is one of his employees, Lamar Gardner. So I ask him, did he know when he took this job that stores at the other side of the mall paid more?
Yeah, he did tell me that. But they wasn't looking, he was looking, so I got it right here.
Yeah. Have you thought about just, you know, checking out what jobs are open over there?
Not at the moment, no. I'm fine.
You say in front of your manager?
Lamar says he stays because the Shoe Palace is willing to work around his schedule. They're flexible. And that's really one of the only things the store manager here can offer to keep his workers. On the other side of the mall, they have a different set of problems.
Hi, welcome to Wetzel Pretzel. How can I help you?
At Wetzel Pretzels on the San Jose side, suddenly they had to pay their lowest wage workers more. A bunch more, initially close to $2 an hour more. That's 25%. And that's great if you work here, not so much if you own the place.
My name is Yvonne Rizak, and I am the owner of 6 Wetzel's Pretzels in California.
Figuring out how to pay her San Jose workers more was a challenge. One option was to somehow sell more pretzels.
And that's how I view everything that I buy and everything to. How many pretzels do I have to sell to pay for this?
Yvonne did the math. And it came to a lot of pretzels, 250 or 300 more pretzels every pay period, every 2 weeks.
Now, I don't sell 250, 300 pretzels more magically just because the minimum wage went up.
Yvonne could cut staff, but she figured that would lead to long lines and she'd lose sales. She could hike pretzel prices, but there's competition in this mall. There's another pretzel shop. And the pretzel business is brutal. I asked Yvonne if she keeps a close eye on the competition's prices, and she whips out her cell phone, pulls up a picture of her competitor's menu, complete with that day's prices. In the end, Yvonne raised her prices a little bit and realized she'd have to live with less profit. As it turns out, this affected her workers too. Yvonne has a policy of paying bonuses every year. Every year, she gives 15% of her profits back to employees.
And it's funny because I just did bonus checks and usually people are so thrilled, but
not this year. Bonuses were smaller. Yvonne's had to remind her employees the bonuses she pays are based on profits. Profits which are smaller because she's already paying them more. Yvonne says she's fine raising the minimum wage. She just wishes it was the same everywhere, across this mall, across California, even across the entire country. But since 2012, here, the opposites happen. The minimum wage rates in this mall have changed again. Actually, twice. Once on the Santa Clara side, and then again in San Jose. Steve Henn, NPR News.
Heading into the Labor Day weekend, the American labor force is not all that happy. There are various signs that the U.S. economy is on the mend, but a new survey from Rutgers University found 2 of 3 Americans have felt no improvement over the last year, and only about 1 in 4 expect things to get better in the year to come. Here's NPR's Scott Horsley.
President Obama spent much of the summer playing cheerleader for the U.S. economy. And if you look at the economic indicators, there's a lot to cheer about. Private employers have added nearly 10 million jobs in recent years. Unemployment has fallen to just above 6%. Auto sales are booming, and forecasters expect a healthy back-to-school shopping season.
By almost every measure, we are better off now than we were when I took office.
So why are so many Americans in such a grumpy mood about the economy? Just ask Robert Stovkin, a car salesman from West Virginia. While auto sales have bounced back from the depths of the downturn, Stovkin says his personal fortunes have never fully recovered.
In the last 6 years, I've switched jobs three times, and I'm making more money than I did 3 years ago, not as much as I did 6 years ago.
What's more, Stovkin worries the economy won't be much better by the time his high school-aged daughter enters the job market a few years from now.
She's going to go to college and get a degree in something that she probably is not going to be able to get a job in, you know. I want her to follow her dreams, but I don't think the dreams are going to be a good-paying job.
Stovkin is one of more than 1,100 people nationwide who were surveyed by Rutgers University about how they'd been affected by the recession and its aftermath. Researcher Cliff Zukin says 42% of those polled are still worse off than when the recession began, while only a third came through the downturn unscathed.
What you're seeing here is, despite outside numbers, the quality of people's lives has not gotten better, and they don't expect to get better.
Another survey respondent, Nina, is a college student in New Jersey who's studying to be a special ed teacher. Her mother always told her that a college degree would be her ticket to economic success, but Nina's watched her older brother struggle to find work. At age 30, he's still living at home.
The amount of money that you're making when you're working doesn't equal up to being able to support yourself. You know, maybe go to the movies, go out to eat once. I don't think it's supporting that.
While the recession officially ended years ago, Zukin says it continues to cast a long shadow over people's attitudes, one that's grown darker with the passage of time. Even 5 years ago, when the unemployment rate was near 10%, most Americans thought the effects of the downturn would be short-lived. Today, after a painfully slow recovery, 71% of those surveyed have come to see the damage as permanent.
There's just such a deep sense of pessimism and malaise in the country, and we really do have a very different political, social, and economic culture coming out of the recession, or not coming out of the recession, than we did before it started.
When President Obama began his second term a year and a half ago, there was still some hope the federal government might be able to address such challenges. Today, only about 1 in 5 Americans has any confidence in government's ability to act. One might expect that would hurt the Democrats in the upcoming midterm elections, but the Rutgers survey found even less faith in giving congressional Republicans control of the economy. Stovkin, the West Virginia car salesman, is doubtful the U.S. economy will ever return to the kind of broad-based prosperity that Americans once took for granted.
There was an American dream where the middle class was happy to be the middle class. You still had rich people and poor people, but nowadays there's not going to be a middle class. It's going to be those that have and those that have not.
Just yesterday, the S&P 500 stock index closed at a new record high. But only about 1 in 7 people Rutgers surveyed was cheered by that. Most said the stock market has little bearing on their family's finances. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Maybe you remember, not so long ago, there was this showdown over the federal budget. It provoked a government shutdown and a market-rattling confrontation over the federal debt ceiling. Well, today, the federal budget deficit seems to have faded both as an economic issue and a political one. To find out what has changed, we turn, as we often do, to David Wessel, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and a contributor to The Wall Street Journal. David, good morning.
Good morning, David.
So I think I know the answer to this question, but I'll ask it anyway. I mean, has the deficit problem somehow been solved here?
No, you're right. It hasn't been. But there is some good news. The economy's been getting better. Congress raised some taxes. It's restrained spending more than some people had expected. And all that has combined to reduce the deficit for the current fiscal year. This year, revenues are expected to be 8% ahead of last year. but spending only 2% ahead of last year. So yesterday, the Congressional Budget Office predicted that this year's deficit for the fiscal year that ends at the end of September will come in at around $500 billion. Now, that's a lot of money, but it's $170 billion less than last year's deficit, and it works out to 2.9% of the gross domestic product. That's slightly below the average for the last 40 years, and it's a far cry from the nearly 10% of GDP deficits that we saw during the worst of the recession.
Okay, well, what I'm getting from all that math there is pretty good news. Is there a but we should know about?
There is a but. The problem is not today's budget deficit. The problem lies in the not-too-distant future. Look, the federal government borrowed a lot of money over the last several years, and it continues to borrow because it's spending more than it takes in. Mm-hmm. If you add up all the money the government has borrowed, the federal debt works out to be about 75% of the gross domestic product. That's twice what it was before the recession, higher than any time since 1950. Now, CBO says it'll level off at that historically high level for a few years and then start to climb again as spending, particularly on health care, climbs faster than taxes under current law. So why do we worry about that? Well, in part because it means the government will have less maneuvering room if it ever wants to borrow heavily again to fight a recession or fight a war or something else expensive. So the problem isn't urgent, but it's not solved.
And part of the problem isn't the argument that many people have made that when you're borrowing a lot of money, you're also paying a whole lot of interest.
Exactly. This year, CBO says that government will spend $230 billion, 7% of all federal spending on interest. But interest rates are sure to rise over the next few years. And so by 2024, 10 years from now, CBO says the interest tab will come to close to $800 billion, 14% of all federal spending. And that's money that won't be available for other things.
You say 2024, David. I mean, we know these 10-year forecasts can always be wrong. They're revised in all sorts of ways. I mean, hasn't the long-term outlook for the deficit been improving?
It has been improving, largely because of a slowdown in the pace at which government health care spending has increased and because Congress has held down some other spending. But the 10-year forecasts are beginning to stabilize. And well, the most interesting thing to me is something that the New York Times pointed out yesterday. A few years ago, CBO said Medicare would cost about $12,700 per beneficiary in 2019, 5 years from now. Mm-hmm. Today, its best guess is 11% lower, $11,300. And with so many people on Medicare, that adds up to a lot of money. So, and also, CBO now thinks interest rates in the future are going to be lower than over the next decade than they previously forecast. That also means smaller deficits than they had predicted.
We're also not seeing this discussed as much in the political realm. And I wonder, what is that a calculation that both parties have made that this isn't a good issue for them? Or are we going to hear about the budget deficit in this fall's midterm elections?
You know, it's kind of interesting. If you look at the polls, the public opinion polls, Americans still tell the pollsters that they worry a lot about the deficit. It usually ranks right up there with jobs and the economy, mm-hmm. though the angst has eased a bit from a few years ago. But from what I see in the campaign, the candidates seem to figure it's not a big issue. The folks who worry about the deficit still say their worries. The folks who thought the deficit issue was overblown still think that. So it doesn't seem to be an issue. Tax and spending is likely to return to the headlines when Congress returns on September 8th because the House and Senate have yet to agree on spending bills to keep the government operating, but they're unable to agree on the big issues, how much to tax, how much to spend, so they're simply going to put those off as they often do.
As they often do. Well, David, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
David Wessel is director of the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy at the Brookings Institution and also a contributing correspondent to the Wall Street Journal.